Okay, good morning. I think we finally have everything running. My name is Pat Fitzgerald-Bocarsley, and I'm a professor at Rutgers New Jersey Medical School, and I'm delighted to be here. I'm moderating the three sessions on life science, and I must say that it's a rather eclectic group of talks. Some are very basic science, so I put most of those here, and going all the way to a session on bioethics tomorrow afternoon. So it's going to be a rather different set. So one of the speakers hasn't checked in here yet. Is Jan Dutz here? Okay, hopefully he'll come. He's our last speaker. And we did have one drop out, so we have a shorter session. I'm gonna ask everyone to try and keep on time, although we're starting late. So I'm gonna be talking to you today about the immune system, and in particular, some components of the innate immune system that my lab is particularly interested in. So innate immunity appears early in phylogeny, and it's comprised of phagocytes in sponges, annelids, and arthropods. So it's going back that far in phylogenetic history. The adaptive components of the immune response, that is the antibodies and the T cell responses, appear first in vertebrates and are the most developed in mammals. And even as in mammals, I'll show you that the innate responses are rather divergent. So the innate immune response is involved in protection of the host against microbial infections and can greatly reduce or even eliminate the burden of the bacteria or viral infection before the adaptive immune response kicks in. And of course, this is critical for those primitive organisms that don't have an adaptive response, that they have to have something that can protect them. But in mammals, the innate and adaptive response are extremely interactive in that one does not exist in a fully functioning manner without the other, so that they have a huge amount of crosstalk. So in the innate immune response, we have common structures that are recognized by innate leukocytes. So here we have three different pathogens, and they're all sharing a common structure that would be present on these pathogens, and these are known as PAMPs, or pathogen-associated molecular patterns. Whereas the adaptive immune response is going to be able to tell the very fine, exquisite differences between these different organisms. And so the B cells and the T cells, with their very exquisitely sensitive receptors, are going to be able to distinguish among those. So when a pathogen-associated molecular pattern interacts with a pattern recognition receptor on innate cells of the immune response, that's going to trigger a lot of different things, including, depending on the cell type, phagocytosis, so that the offending organism can be cleared, target cell lysis in some cases, and also starting inflammation to recruit in players of the adaptive immune response and other innate cells. So the gene family I want to talk to you about today is the Toll gene family. It was first identified in 1985 by Christian Nusslin-Volkart and Eric Vichas. And then the actual Toll gene in Drosophila was cloned in 1988 and eventually led to the Nobel Prize in 1995 for these individuals. So the Toll name is not an abbreviation. You might know that the Drosophila people are known for giving unique names to the genes that they discover. So in this case, it actually came from Christian's exclamation in reference to an underdeveloped ventral portion of a fruit fly when they eliminated this gene. And she said, "Das ist ja toll," meaning amazing. So that's where we got toll receptors. It turned out that when they looked further into these flies that could survive, that lack of this gene was associated with lack of control of fungal infection. So it was multi-purpose. It can control development, but as well as development of fungus. So here is a scanning EM of a Drosophila that has the Toll gene knocked out, and all of this is fungus that's all over his body. So it was a very dramatic effect. So this led Charlie Janeway and Ruslan Medjikov to look for the equivalent of the Toll gene in mammals to see whether it might be conserved. In Drosophila and ultimately in mammals, the Toll-like genes look like this. So they have an extracellular portion which has these leucine-rich repeats in this coiled form, a transmembrane section, and then the signaling domain, which is called a TIR domain. And it can bind to various factors that are ultimately going to lead to transcription of specific genes in the activated cell. So the mammalian toll was originally assumed by Ruslan Medjikov to be a single gene. So the very first paper published in Science in 1997, where they looked for an analogous gene, described it as the mammalian toll. It was analogous to the Drosophila toll gene with the extracellular domain with leucine-rich repeats, and then that intracellular domain, which was actually homologous to another receptor in the immune system called the interleukin-1 receptor. It turns out that toll genes are widely conserved so that throughout phylogeny, and even plants have a gene that's recognized as a toll-like gene that leads to expression of defensins, which are protective peptide proteins, so that they're even in plants. So in humans, it turns out that there are 10 toll-like receptors that are expressed, and they have different functions and different abilities to recognize different PAMPs from pathogens. And just like in real estate, it's location, location, location that's really important. Toll-like receptors are expressed in different subsets of cells so that all 10 are not expressed in the same cell and in different subcellular locations. So the ones that are found on the cell surface of the appropriate cells recognize bacterial products that are or fungal products that are extracellular. So toll-like receptor 2 dimerizes with TLR 6 or 1, and it can recognize diacyl lipopeptides or triacyl lipopeptides from bacteria. Toll-like receptor 5 recognizes flagellin, which is the main protein in flagellated bacteria that's going to be a good target for immune attack. And then importantly, and I'll get back to this one a bit later, toll-like receptor 4 recognizes the gram-negative bacteria component LPS. The ones most interesting to me in my laboratory are actually expressed in the endosomal compartment. And here they have the C-type portion of the molecule into the lumen of the endosome and the signaling molecule again into the cytoplasm. So that they've got a reverse orientation, but again going into the cytoplasm. So toll-like receptor 7 recognizes single-stranded RNA, so viruses like HIV or influenza. Toll-like receptor 3, which is found in different subsets, recognizes double-stranded RNA, and which is a common replicative intermediate of many viruses. And toll-like receptor 9 recognizes non-methylated CpG sequences in DNA and also viruses such as herpes simplex virus, which is a double-stranded DNA virus. So the cells that we study in our laboratory are called plasmacytoid dendritic cells, and these are the professional interferon-producing cells in the body. And they represent a very low percentage of circulating white blood cells, between 0.2 and 0.5%. Our lab was the first to describe these, along with another lab about 25 years ago. Initially, their existence was doubted by many, but fortunately, the NIH kept believing in us and funding our research, so we were pretty fortunate. These cells make more than 300 to 1,000 times more type 1 interferon, so that's interferon alpha and beta, than any other cell in the body. And that's why they are considered the professional cells. And this cytokine is critical for directing antiviral immunity, both by setting up an antiviral status in surrounding uninfected cells, as well as activating cells of the innate and adaptive immune response. But they're also important not only in antiviral immunity, but in autoimmunity, immune responses to tumors, and cardiovascular disease. They signal through the production of interferon, or through the toll-like receptor 7 for RNA viruses and toll-like receptor 9 for DNA viruses. And sometimes they recognize self-DNA or RNA in complexes with antibodies that the DNA or RNA is released from dying cells. So for example, in lupus, when the cells start dying, then you're going to start getting antibodies, anti-DNA and anti-nuclear antibodies that are going to be directed against that DNA, then that can also trigger toll-like receptor 9 stimulation. And toll-like receptor 7 is encoded on the X chromosome, and the fact that they can also respond, these cells can respond to RNA, suggests in part some of the reason why there is such a high preponderance of autoimmunity in females is toll-like receptor 7 and many other critical genes of the immune response are found in women. So while women have a better resistance in some ways to infection, they also tend to have the hyperreactions, more of the hyperreactions that can lead to autoimmunity. And this is an electron micrograph that one of my students took of the plasmacytoid DC. And what it has here is a whole lot of endoplasmic reticulum. That means that it's good at secreting lots of protein. So these PDCs are really specialized virus experts. So they've got all kinds of surface receptors that allow them to pick up that are pattern recognition receptors of all different categories to pick up viruses. They also have high constitutive levels of toll-like receptor 7 and 9, so they're unique in the body in that regard. They also have a very high expression of a transcription factor known as IRF7, which has to be expressed at high levels in these cells in order for them to give this huge response of interferon production. And as I showed you on the EM, they also have this extensive ER, so that this combination of things together make these cells the exquisitive professionals of the interferon world. So interferon alpha is really a two-edged sword, or to use another analogy, I call it the Goldilocks effect, where the amount of interferon produced in the body needs to be very carefully controlled and has to be just right. So just like Goldilocks didn't want it too hot or too cold, we don't want too much or too little interferon. So if you have too little interferon, then you get increased susceptibility to viral infections and decreased T and B cell responses. And how we first got into the field was early in the HIV epidemic, showing that individuals that couldn't make interferon, now we know through this cell, have increased opportunistic infections leading to AIDS. On the other hand, if you have hyperactivation of these cells, then you get increased autoimmunity, for example, as in systemic lupus that I just mentioned, and also induction of some killer molecules on PDCs that will lead to killing of uninfected cells in HIV and some other pathological situations. So my lab is very interested in studying the function and activation of PDCs, and we were, as I mentioned, among the first to describe these cells, and we were the first to describe their central role in HIV pathogenesis, where the cells are both lost and dysregulated, so that the cells that are remaining tend to produce the interferon in an aberrant way. So interaction, we also study interaction of viruses with other pathogens in PDCs. So we've been looking at bacteria interactions and also Toxoplasma gondii, which is a eukaryotic single-cell parasite that can invade these cells. And we're also comparing PDCs to other dendritic cells and looking at signaling pathways. So we don't really have time to show you a lot of that data today, but I do want to show you just a little bit of our data on some of the work we're doing in aging effects on PDCs, especially in the context of HIV infection. So with effective antiretroviral therapy, instead of being a 10-year or 12-year death sentence given to individuals infected with this virus, the average age of a person in the U.S. living with HIV is now approaching 50. And so now we've got the scenario where we've got individuals that are both infected with HIV and on antiretroviral drug and aging along. And we know that the immune system has aging, shows an aging phenotype. So we wanted to know, what's the effect of aging with a chronic viral infection like this? So patients with HIV have early dementia, cardiovascular disease, frailty. So even though they're living longer, there are some issues with quality of life that bring into that still need to be addressed. Even when virus is totally suppressed by antiretroviral treatment, there's still this immune activation that's going on, leading to, we believe, many of these phenomena. So we've been comparing young versus older HIV positive and negative individuals. And for the purposes of this, we've been using as our young group at 18 to 30 year olds, and our older group is 50 to 65. So we're not looking at the very old geriatric subjects. First, we don't have HIV patients that have lived that long yet. But in fact, in that group, there's actually a selection for people with the best immune systems anyway. So we're very interested in this 50 and up group, which unfortunately, for those of us that are past 50, I hate to say it, but we're considered to be immunosenescent. So, but what we see is that if we look at the numbers of PDCs per microliter of blood and compare that between younger and older HIV non-infected individuals, we see that there's a natural decline of about half with between those two different age groups. But interestingly, when we look at the young HIV subjects, they have a number of PDCs that looks more like the older HIV negative group than like the younger HIV negative group. And this becomes exacerbated even more as the patients age, so that the 50-year-olds, even with good antiretroviral control, have many fewer. And this correlates with similar reduction in amount of interferon alpha produced by these cells. And this work was done by Dr. Jihong Dai in my lab. So we also demonstrate that the HIV-infected subjects have an activated phenotype that gets accentuated with age. So here we're looking at a molecule called CD40 on these cells and using flow cytometry, as shown on the left, and the summary is on the right. So here we have younger HIV-infected versus older. There's a small but not yet significant upregulation of CD40 just with age, but with HIV there's a dramatic upregulation in the young, and again that gets exacerbated even more in the older HIV-infected. So we have a superimposed upon this aging, we have this immune activation phenotype, probably driven by virus itself. And in addition, we have demonstrated that PDCs have shortened telomeres, perhaps suggesting replicative senescence. And I apologize, this isn't coming out quite right on this slide. So we measured the length of telomeres using flow cytometry. And what we see is that in young HIV-infected individuals, we have about twice, the telomeres are about twice as long as any of the other three groups. So telomeres, as you know, shorten as the cells have divided many times. The PDCs themselves are end cells, but their precursors, we predict, have divided many times and are starting to show this senescence. And our studies that we are just got funded to do, we're going to be looking in the bone marrow of healthy and HIV-infected subjects to prove that the precursors to these cells have the shortened telomeres. So switching back to a more general topic then, since toll-like receptors are highly conserved, can we count on animal models, and in particular, mouse models that immunologists favor to drive pathway and drug discovery? So mice provide outstanding opportunities to interrogate pathogen resistance pathways in vivo. We can make gene knockouts and knock-ins, and we can make these global or tissue-specific. So you can look at the effect of toll-like receptor 9 knockout, for example, or you could look at it only in PDCs. Mice also allow us to do in vivo infection. We can do reconstitution experiments where we make chimeras between different types of mice. However, although we can provide valuable preclinical data before taking studies into the human, it's important to remember that mice are not little people. And so we have to, they have a totally different metabolism, they have a totally different lifespan. So not everything can one expect is going to apply from mouse to human. In plasmacytoid-dendritic cells, for example, toll-like receptor 9 expression is very different. So in humans, toll-like receptor 9 is restricted to PDCs, and also some B cells express it in humans, whereas in mice, it's very broadly expressed in all the phagocytic cells as well as B cells. And other cytokines that are critical for immune responses are produced. For example, IL-12 is a major product of mouse PDCs, but not of humans. So that's a major difference when we're studying disease pathogenesis. In addition, some of the toll-like receptors aren't present at all in humans. So an example of this are toll-like receptor 11 and 12, and then there's a recent description of toll-like receptor 13 that are expressed in mice. So in Toxoplasma gondii infection, which our lab was studying, it's an important human pathogen that affects a huge portion of the world's population. There it has a molecule known as profilin that in the mouse interacts with toll-like receptor 11 and 12 and contributes to innate response, especially in PDCs. So the problem is in humans, TLR11 and 12 are pseudogenes, so that there are mutations such that the proteins never get expressed. And so humans, therefore, through the eons of evolution, have had to have divergent responses to deal with this pathogen. So even though there's a lot of beautiful work in the mouse in TLR11 and 12, it's not relevant to humans. So we have to have other protective mechanisms. So another huge example of this are the gram-negative bacteria product, LPS. So this is just the cell wall of a gram-negative bacteria. And present in this is lipopolysaccharide, which is a very, very strong immune stimulus, shown here. So bacterial walls contain this. And the toll-like receptor that recognizes lipopolysaccharide, also known as endotoxin, is toll-like receptor 4. So this LPS-TLR4-driven access is really important in human health, in sepsis, burns, and trauma. These diseases are major killers that affect 750 million of a million patients in the U.S. every year and kills between 25% of them. And the estimated cost of dealing with patients in the intensive care unit is $17 billion per year. So starting with mouse models, there were really exciting leads, including inhibiting this TLR-LPS axis that have led to 150 clinical trials. And all 150 trials completely failed in patients despite the drugs that worked in mice. So it's been very, very disturbing. The mechanism by which this kills people is ramped up immune system. So it's an overactive response leading to a cytokine storm. And you end up with having septic shock, ultimately multiple organ failure, and is the major cause of death in intensive care units, I've read. So one of the reasons why this has the big difference between mouse and humans is that mice evolved in a very dirty environment and have to be able to deal with large amounts of bacterial type of infection. So the lethal dose in mice is 5 to 25 milligrams per kilogram of LPS. Whereas in humans, it's 1 million times lower. So that's just a really striking difference. So a paper that made a big splash last year in PNAS discussed this and addressed all of these different studies. And they did genomic responses, looking at what happens in mice versus humans with these burns and trauma. So the genomic responses in mouse models were found to poorly mimic human inflammatory disease. So that means that the same sets of genes are not getting turned on. And this is in burns, endotoxemia, and trauma. So therefore, the animal models don't always recapitulate human disease. And we need more human studies, but obviously we can't ethically do studies with LPS, for example, in humans, or many of the things, or infecting them with viruses that we could do in mice. So we also need better animal models that would better recapitulate the human situation. So I just wanted to spend the last 2 minutes talking about my journey of faith. Like the person who introduced the speaker this morning, I also had come from a different perspective as a young Christian, and really tried to avoid the whole issue of evolution. And I managed to teach medical students for 20 years without ever mentioning the word evolution. And I guess as I learned more and more about biology, I became more and more impressed with the intricacy of creation and incontrovertible evidence that God's mechanism of creation is through the evolution process for leading to humans. So I borrowed a quote from John Donne for the title of my talk, where he says, "No man is an island entire of itself. Every man is a piece of the continent." I would argue that we are all pieces of this biological creation that started very primitive and became very complex. And finally, "Therefore, never send to know for whom the bell tolls, it tolls for thee." So I would say we are all interrelated. And thank you. Are there any questions? Yes. The next year? Well, we've been studying the basic biology of these cells that we're studying and uncovering mechanisms, and then we look in the clinical scenario. But since we just got the grant from the NIH for 4 years to study aging in HIV, that's going to be one of our main focus over the next several years.
I think that's really, really exciting.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Is there another question here? Yeah.
Just a question about autoimmunity in females.
Uh-huh.
You said this could be because the TLR7 is expressed on the X chromosome.
Right.
And therefore it's more active. Maybe my view of cytogenetics or whatever is old and naive, but I thought I was always taught one of the X chromosomes.
Yeah. Yeah. So the question is, why does it matter if TLR7 is on the X chromosome if one gets inactivated? It turns out that that's true in many cells, but not all cells, and that there are cells that express the double dose, so that females, for example, actually have higher levels of toll-like receptor 7. And it's not just that. There's a bunch of other things that are encoded on the X chromosome as well. So. Yeah, I mean, that's an excellent question. Two quick questions.
Quick one. You mentioned you had like a mouse model. I was curious if on the other side, if you had a human model, trying to compare the response.
Right. So my lab works predominantly with humans. We've done some work with macaques and a little bit of work with mice. So because we work a lot with HIV and that doesn't infect mice, we can't use HIV infection in mice except in a humanized mouse model where you give a immunodeficient mouse a human model. So we haven't done a lot of direct comparisons, but a colleague and I are planning on writing a review that describes the differences and how we can't extrapolate everything from the mouse to the human in this scenario.
Like
A mathematical model. Ouch. That's outside of my pay grade. I absolutely agree that we need people. We need to have start doing more mathematical modeling, and I don't have that ability. I would hopefully with our new relationship with Rutgers, we'll be able to have collaborators. Okay, one quick question.
Yeah. So my question is, is there any kinds of human cancer that always express this receptor?
There are some human cancers that are actually the PDC becomes the leukemic cell. But it's also been shown that presence of PDCs in breast cancer infiltrate, and that's associated with a poor prognosis, and then they have a more suppressive phenotype. But in terms of the cancers themselves expressing, it would be mostly in a few of these hematopoietic cell tumors. Okay, I think we need to move along.